Greetings. So some of you may have wondered when Gil talked yesterday about clear comprehension of domain, why we didn't do suitability. And today I'm also not going to talk about suitability. I'm planning to, in our plan for this retreat, we decided to have the conversation around suitability be the last night's talk, essentially looking at how we can bring clear comprehension into our daily lives. And it feels like the clear comprehension of suitability is it really speaks to that well. So today we're going to move to clear comprehension of non-delusion. This aspect of clear comprehension is connected to seeing experience as it is, as it actually is. Our human system tends to experience the world through a number of layers, a number of filters, some of which are culturally conditioned, and some of which are more embedded in our human nature. Some of the ways in which we tend to not see things as they are, the ways in which some of the more foundational or fundamental ways that delusion operates, is at a very human level. It is across cultures we share these kinds of delusions, these kinds of mistakes, misperceptions, misunderstandings about the nature of our experience. In the teachings of the Buddha, points to how our usual perspective on the world is not aligned with the truth of things as they actually are. And this perspective is not a passive not knowing of the truth. It's more of an active distortion of experience. If it were simply about information, we could be told the information and we would start to perhaps see things in a different way, but these delusions operate at a kind of more fundamental level, and they're active distortions. It's not so this delusion is not about just simply not knowing something. It's an active misperception, an active distortion of experience. Yesterday, Gil, speaking about the domain of our practice, being the place where we are nourished in particular in terms of what leads us in the direction of freedom, of non-clinging, of release. That the domain is that terrain in which we could say the wholesome is nourished. The way delusion operates, it kind of is one of the ways that delusion operates, is that it's having us believe that we are being nourished in places that are actually not nourishing. Being nourished by things that are not nourishing in terms of what leads us to freedom. But today, in terms of exploring this topic, I'd like to kind of orient to or be curious about exploring with you how we might become aware of some of these delusions, how we might become aware of these fundamental misperceptions. And that the beginning to understand, beginning to become aware of delusion, how it works in our minds, is one, perhaps we could say, a step in the direction of opening to clear comprehension of non-delusion. We have to know delusion in order to understand non-delusion. Now that may sound like, how can we possibly know delusion? But we can. There's some understandings that are some descriptions and some understandings conveyed in some of the teachings that help us to kind of orient to the particular places where our human minds get confused. And through orienting to those and being curious about those confusions, we can begin to understand something of how delusion works. So there's some core delusions that are pointed to. And they kind of reflect, in a way, the flip side, which is the wisdom that we, the wisdom that frees our mind, the understanding that experience is impermanent, unreliable, and not self. This is the wisdom that we begin to open to through the practice of being in the domain, knowing our experience as experience in the present moment. We start to see that experience is impermanent, unreliable, and not self. The core delusions are the inversion of those. We tend to take what is impermanent to be permanent. We tend to take what is unreliable to be reliable. And we tend to take what is not self to be self. And so, looking at each of these briefly, seeing what is impermanent is permanent. The nature of our experience the nature of the way our human system processes experience, we could say, perhaps. There's a lot of information coming in. And in some ways, in order to navigate all of that information coming in, our mind simplifies. It simplifies through the use of concept. It also kind of smooths out the amount of changing information that comes in. And just as an example, if I had a camera hooked to my head and it, you know, kind of looked around the room and we played the film back of what my head was doing, of what the camera saw. If you looked at that, it would look pretty jumpy. You know, the every time the head moves, every time if the camera could even track the eyes, every time the eyes move, it's like there's a new, like, image. But our system, our human system, is designed to smooth that out. So when I look through these eyes and look around the room, it doesn't look like the room is jumping around. It looks pretty stable. It looks pretty smooth. And this is just one way that the perceptual system kind of reinforces this notion of stability. And so, our system tends to kind of smooth things out a little bit. There was one time I was at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, and we walked into the Exploratorium, and on the ceiling, hung kind of towards the back of the wall, I saw some bars. They were probably 10 feet long, maybe 4 or 5 inches around, and there were flashing lights on those bars. There are probably 15 or so of these bars hanging maybe 4 or 5 feet apart. And it was just flashing lights on these bars. And I looked at that and thought, I wonder what that's about. And just kind of forgot about it and went around looking at the other exhibits. And at one point I was at the Exploratorium with my nephew, and we'd stopped and sat down to have a snack, have a little drink or something. And he's looking up and kind of looking around, and suddenly he says, "Wow, it's a school bus." And I look up and he's looking at these bars with the flashing lights on them, and I said, "What? What are you saying?" And then he said, "Now it's butterflies." I was like, "What are you talking about? I don't see this." And so I took some time. I took some time to stand there and, like, observe these flashing lights. And at some point there was a kind of a way that the perceptual system oriented to the flashing lights, and it was like, instead of seeing bars, the mind perceived a screen. The screen about 10 feet high and maybe 40 feet long, and across that screen was driving a school bus. Now, I understand from the description of this thing, you know, that basically the lights flashing on this, it's kind of like each bar, the lights flashing on this bar, are the perceptual system, like, kind of, if the eyes moved at just the right pace from bar to bar, it's like the perceptual system carried the image of the light flashing from one bar to another. And so it's almost like if you're looking through a fence at something, you know, somebody walking on the other side of the fence, you can kind of fill in the gaps there between the slats of the fence. It's kind of what the mind was doing here. So what was actually going on were these like flashes of lights, this just like bits of information, and the mind created an object or a kind of a permanence, a sense of there being something there that wasn't actually there. And what was amazing to me actually is that the detail on the image of the school bus was so clear that I could read the name of the school district on the side of the school bus. This is the level at which our perceptual system creates continuity. It was astounding to me. I knew what was actually there was just bars with flashing lights. The perceptual system saw a screen with a school bus driving across it. So this is also, you know, the part of this is the bars were rapidly flashing change in the lights. And so the part of our perceptual system is that it kind of, when there's rapid change, it kind of smooths that out and makes sense of that rapid change. So, as we start to be curious about our experience in this, just what is actually happening here? We start to recognize that also concept can obscure or mask change. So the rapidity of change can mask change, but also an idea, a kind of a sense that we are looking at something. So for instance, I know many of you have explored or noticed pain in your meditative career. And if you're looking at pain from the perspective of the concept of pain, it can feel like a block. It can feel like something solid, something really, you know, permanent and big. But then if you kind of get curious about, well, what's the actual experience there? What's the actual experience that's happening? You might notice a very dynamic kind of changing experience. The concept of pain overlaid on top of that experience often creates the sense of something more solid. And we if we're experiencing the sensations through the concept of pain, we may not be noticing the rapidity of change, may not be noticing how it comes and goes, how it flashes in and out. So one way to begin to explore this aspect of how our minds tend to distort this is if there's something in your experience that feels solid or stable. This understanding that nothing lasts for very long, the kind of the truth of impermanence, the truth of the rapidity of which our system is taking in information and things are changing, then when there's something that feels solid, it can be interesting to explore, well, what is that? What is it that it feels solid? Is it really as solid as I think it is? Like, what are you taking to be permanent? And being curious about that. So this is a way in to explore this, taking what is impermanent to be permanent, noticing what our minds take to be permanent, and being curious. Is it actually permanent? If I allow the mind to rest with that thing that seems so solid and stable, what happens? Does it start to see subtle fluctuations? Does it start to see the changing nature of that experience? There's nothing in our experience that lasts for more than a split second. And so if it feels like something is lasting for longer than that, that is worth exploring. It is worth, you know, taking in this. Oh, this is the mind taking this to be solid and stable. So at first we kind of just may just need to recognize or know this is the mind taking something to be permanent. So that's a way in which we inform ourselves of this delusion. And if we don't have to agree that it's impermanent yet. I mostly am curious to have you begin to investigate. Be curious about it. Is it actually permanent? You don't have to convince your mind that it's not permanent. Just be curious about it. The second kind of distortion or misunderstanding is that we tend to take what is unreliable as a lasting source of happiness to be reliable. This is the delusion that's embedded in wanting, in desire, that delusion that if I get this thing, I'll be happy. And not only is the delusion of greed that kind of flavor of if I get this thing, I'll be happy. The delusion in that is that there's a kind of a deeper level of delusion in that we believe that this kind of happiness that comes from getting what I want is as good as it gets. Maybe we kind of know that it's not permanent, lasting happiness, but we don't really understand or we still feel like, well, that's, if I'm going to have any happiness, this is where it's going to come. We don't quite understand that there's other ways happiness arises. The happiness of letting go. The happiness of non-clinging. So this, again, is like, where are we searching for happiness? Where are we thinking happiness will be found? Getting what we want does bring a certain kind of happiness. And that's why we tend to go there. Because it does give us a moment of feeling like, oh yeah, that's nice having that. And then when that fades, we kind of look for, well, the last time I felt really good was when I got something I wanted, so what can I find to get so that I can have that moment of happiness again? And we just end up on this like cycle of trying to get the next thing so that we have as many of those moments of getting that hit of happiness, getting that hit of, oh, I got that thing. That feels good. So we try to create our lives. We end up like kind of in this cycle of trying to just accumulate those moments. The Buddha encouraged us to acknowledge, he acknowledged that there is a kind of happiness that comes from getting what we want. But he encouraged us to look at how reliable is that happiness. The teaching the language that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses is we're encouraged to look at the gratification that comes with getting something that we want and to explore how far does that gratification extend. So how long does the happiness last when we get it? How long does it last? We start to really see the instability of that happiness, the unreliability of that happiness, and that our mind has been looking for happiness in this place that is not very reliable. Another interesting exploration around this, I mentioned in terms of looking at the impermanent nature of experience, that concept, you know, was overlaid on experience and tends to obscure or mask the impermanent nature of experience. That when we're seeing experience through the concept lens, and that's a lot of how we navigate experience. We know experience through the concepts rather than through the direct experience. That's essentially the way in which, when I look around the room, that the mind isn't seeing things jumping all over the place because of the concept of the objects being stable. So I'm not seeing a little flash of the chair and then another flash of it looking like something else and a flash of it looking like something else. I see the chair. And it doesn't matter that my head is moving and getting different images of the chair. The mind sees the chair because it's holding the concept of the chair. In the looking, as we start to look at the what it is that we're taking, where we're looking for happiness, we also might recognize that some of the places that we look for happiness, like what do we actually want when we want something? We think we want the thing, perhaps, but a kind of a curiosity and an investigation about what we actually want can be very interesting. It's like, what is it that we think we're going to get from this thing? Often there's a whole bunch of ideas that float around with the idea of the happiness of the getting. So for instance, you know, if I get this thing, then if I get this new car, for instance, then I'm not going to have problems with my car having those mechanical failures anymore, and it's going to be much easier for me. And so it's kind of a whole host of ideas about what this new car is going to do for me. It's actually when we start to look at what we actually want is not some real thing. What we want is a concept. This is an exploration for you. It's kind of like when there is something that you find you want. It can be, you know, if you're caught in that wanting in the sense of it, yeah, if I get that thing, then I'm going to be happy. It can be interesting to look at. Well, what is the happiness? What is the idea of the happiness that thinks it's going to come? What is the wanting about? What is actually being wanted? Mostly, we want a concept, not the actual thing. And what is a concept? It's a fleeting thing. It's an impermanent, unreliable thing in the mind. So again, curiosity about where you think you're going to find happiness, looking at that. What is it that you actually want? And If you get that, how far does the gratification extend? How reliable is the happiness? Does it give it as much as we thought it would? Does it give us as much as we thought it would? And what happens when that moment of happiness, or those the kind of sense of happiness around something, fades? What happens then? What does the mind do then? It tends to start looking for the next thing to find a hit of happiness on. Then this third way of taking what is not self to be self. Again, the exploration is, what is it that we take to be self? To explore it from the perspective of delusion, we don't try to come up with some bypassing of a sense of self, but a real honesty, this sense of self is what's arising. What is that? What am I taking to be self? How stable is it? This can be very interesting. We tend to, with senses of self, we tend to take them to be stable, kind of a sense of, this is me, and we carry it through time. And, you know, when I've really started looking at my own sense of self, and I have to now say it's not one. There are many, many senses of self that the mind has woven together to create some kind of thought that there's a coherent whole sense of self. But looking at what I'm taking to be self, looking at that experience in the moment, what am I taking to be self? From moment to moment, it can shift, it can change radically. In one moment, you know, there might be a sense of self relating to a particular role, a particular, set of conditions. And then in the next moment, something happens, conditions change, and our mind picks up a whole different set of interpretations and identifications. It can happen really quickly, this shift. And as, again, being aware in the moment what we are taking to be self, we start to see that there's not a lot of stability in what we're taking to be self. And so that begins to undermine our sense that there is something stable around a sense of self. Before I started practicing, I had a very strong view of myself as being miserable. I was often feeling put upon, feeling lonely, left out, all kinds of things that kind of put me in this place of feeling miserable. And kind of looking back on my experience as I began to understand something of the nature of my mind, I can see that what I used to do, I mean, it wasn't that I was like never not miserable, but what my mind did when I experienced happiness was something like, well, yeah, I'm happy now, but I know what I really am is miserable. Kind of talking myself into the stability of that, not taking in that miserableness was an identity that kind of arose at times based on conditions and wasn't there at other times. It's like, why didn't I impute the permanence to the happiness instead of the miserableness? It's like, I don't know which, you know, whether one arose more or not, but, you know, it's kind of like the mind for some reason latched onto the miserableness and imputed a sense of kind of stability to that. And so this kind of investigation of what are you taking to be self, and again, perhaps a sense of, is it always there? especially for senses of self that are ones that we frequently identify with or think, that's me. Really useful to notice when it's not there. Notice that it's there sometimes and it's not there sometimes. It begins to poke holes in our belief that it is always, that it's there somehow, or that it's, that's me. So again, the investigation of what is it that I'm taking to be self? With each of these, we orient towards exploring the delusion by being curious about what am I taking to be solid, stable? What am I taking to be reliable? What am I taking to be self? And that helps us to start to see how delusion works in our mind. These distortions, these delusions, operate at different levels in our psyche, in our mind. There's one teaching that talks about these distortions operating at the level of perception, at the level of thought, and at the level of view. And so, for instance, we might, at the level of perception, we might take an experience in, and just the way perception works, it's kind of a pattern-matching thing. It does the best job it can of matching what we're seeing with what we've known before. And so there's a kind of like a pattern-matching that happens. And we might... just recently, I was walking down the sidewalk, and there was a kind of a shape, a kind of a shape that was, you know, laying on the sidewalk, that was a long, thin, stretched out shape, and there was a perception for a moment, oh, is that a snake? And immediately the mind could see, oh no, it's not a snake, it's just the crack in the sidewalk. But there was a split second where the mind kind of perceived it as snake. That's kind of like a pattern matching thing. You know, it's like the mind sees this particular shape and color and based on experience in the past, picks it up, and that's a distortion or a misperception that in at the perceptual level. And when there's a mistake at the perceptual level, it usually doesn't take too much to correct it if you have a second look at it or, you know, get some further information. But if at the level of the next level, there's a kind of a thought that we perhaps, you know, see that, we perceive that thing, and then we kind of go the next level and start thinking. You know, it's like, oh, that's a snake. That means this and this and this. You know, it's kind of like our minds start thinking about it. It's just beginning to get to the point of believing it's a snake, but it starts thinking about it in this way. So that's the next level of distortion. We've picked up essentially the concept and started playing with it in our mind. The third level of distortion is the level of view, where we actually start to believe that the perception, the thought, is what it is, and it's going to be hard to convince us otherwise. You know, like we were walking down the street, we saw this thing, we thought it was a snake, we walked way around it, we were convinced it was a snake. And then somebody else like took a walk and we came back to them and said, wow, did you see that snake? And no, I didn't see any snake. And well, you missed it. There was a snake there. And then, and so you've got it in your mind. You've got this belief there was a snake. And somebody else says, you know, I walked on that. There was not a snake there. I know there was not a snake there. But you cannot be convinced because the view is so strong that... you believe the view, and it's hard even with evidence to the contrary that your view is not the case. Now, this may sound like, you know, this sounds like a kind of a silly example, but at the same time, you know, this level of distortion is happening to us all the time, in particular around the sense of self. You know, we believe in that sense of self so much. There's so much evidence to the contrary that there's so much evidence for the truth of not self. But even in the face of that, we are not. For instance, you know, the fact that we cannot control our thoughts, you know, that came up today in the groups that, you know, judgment, self-judgment would arise after the mind wandered in thought and you know, checking in, you know, it's like, if you had the choice, you know, if you had control, you know, and this is what our minds tell us, you know, it's like, I'm judging myself, I should be able to stop judging myself. Well, try that. Can you stop judging yourself? Can you just turn it off? Can you say to your mind, stop judging? Sometimes we can kind of recognize, well, that's not so helpful, and kind of let it go. But often we can't just flip the switch. Like, we can't just say, yeah, mind be different. That's actually evidence for not self. The Buddha pointed to that in one of his teachings. He said, you know, mental formations are not self. Judgment is a mental formation. We can put judgment in there. You know, judgment is not self. If judgment were self, it would be possible to say of judgment, may judgment be thus or not be thus. But it is not self. So it is not possible to say of judgment, may judgment be thus or not be thus. It is this uncontrollable, the sense that, you know, when the sense of self is frustrated, it's usually running into evidence for not self. And so instead of frustration, maybe this can be an exploration. What is the not self nature that's showing up? So that's this kind of view that I am a self is so strong that it's very hard for us to see the evidence for not self. So these three distortions, these three levels of distortions, I want to go through an example from my practice that kind of revealed all three levels to me. First, I'll tell the story, and then I'll kind of go back and point to the various mistakes in perception that happened. So, I was meditating in Burma. I was usually meditating in my room in the afternoons, and it seemed like most days at the, you know, late afternoon hour, I would hear this squealing sound. And that squealing sound was perceived as a pig squealing. This kind of, you know, it's like I lived in a dormitory that was right near the wall of the meditation center. And there were lots of sounds that came over the wall from the village that was not too far from there, you know, sounds of loudspeakers and people and squealing. And I thought, okay, well, this is a pig squealing. So that's essentially perception, right? That's perception. It's like the sound is being perceived as a pig. And so the mind then started to, you know, think about this, and you know, the thinking about the sound of the pig and the squealing sound. The squealing sounded kind of distressed to me. And my mind created the view, the idea that this regular everyday squealing sound that was happening was because there was a pig farmer on the other side who was slaughtering the pig for the next day selling at the market. And so that I knew that was a view. I knew that I didn't know that that was happening. But that was the story my mind created, and you know, there was compassion in the heart for the pig that was being slaughtered, and so you know, the view shaped the feelings. And this went on for a couple weeks, you know, this experience, this regular every night hearing the squealing, seeing these images of pigs and pigs being slaughtered, and feeling the compassion. And then one evening, instead of doing the meditation in my room, I decided to do walking meditation at about that time. So I just walking up and down the driveway in the middle of the monastery, and I began kind of noticing there were these bats that were like flying at me. You know, it's like they would come right at me and then veer off. It was like there were a lot of them, but they never hit me. They were just kind of like, you know, flying all around me, and these bats were squealing. These bats were squealing. And in that moment, there was the recognition that the mind had misperceived. So it was very quick that misperception was corrected quickly when the information, the extra information was given, you know, the information about seeing the bats. So the misperception was corrected quickly. But what was kind of amazing to me was that while I knew, it was kind of amazing, I knew that there was, that it was a view, that I did not know that pigs were being slaughtered on the other side of the wall. I knew that I didn't know that. But it had not occurred to me that there were not even pigs on the other side of the wall. That I had believed. That view that there were pigs on the other side of the wall. So that perception of the squeal coming into being perceived as a pig, shifted from being the, just thinking about it as a pig into an actual view that it was a pig. It's like, it was shocking to me to recognize that I had, you know, for 2 weeks been believing there were pigs on the other side of the wall. So these three different levels of perception or misperception kind of feed into each other too. So when we have a view of something, that, you know, the belief in that view then influences how we perceive things, further reinforcing that perception, for leading to more thoughts about that, which further reinforces the view. This kind of cycle happens between these levels of misperception. And so becoming curious about the teaching on delusion begins to point us to, there's some specific areas that we can be curious about. If we're taking something to be permanent, or taking something to be reliable, or taking something to be self, you don't have to convince yourself to not take it to be that. But investigate, be curious about it. Suffering can be a useful kind of metric for us, or, you know, if we are suffering, there is some kind of delusion present. So when there's suffering present, and delusion, I think I said this a few days ago, often is at the level of belief. And so there can be a kind of a power to, as you're exploring suffering, a power to being curious about, well, what's being believed here? What's being believed? We can also hold or help our minds to have some ease around the suffering. It's like when there is suffering, as I said, there's some kind of delusion present. Sometimes if we just remind ourselves of some of the foundational truths, this is unreliable. Like, this is dukkha. I'm kind of pointing to that truth. This is dukkha. That was quite amazing to me as I you know, kind of the mind shifted instead of, you know, kind of being embedded in the suffering to recognizing, oh, this is what the Buddha asked us to understand. This is dukkha. That wisdom reflection helped there to be a little more capacity to hold and be curious, investigate that. Or perhaps, depending on, you may have a sense that the mind is clinging to something being stable or wanting something to be kind of solid or lasting. And just reminding yourself, this is impermanent. This won't last. So sometimes we can use wisdom reflections, thoughts in the mind, that can help the mind to be able to hold and be curious about these ways that we're suffering as we're deluded by these delusions. The wool gets pulled over our eyes by these delusions. Sometimes in this process, we do start to see through delusion as we explore, open to what is this thing that I'm taking to be stable, and it begins to kind of be shown as unstable, or we see the not self nature of our experience. It's just a thought arising. It's not me. There's a way in which the mind kind of releases sometimes in the seeing of that, the seeing through that delusion. There's a kind of an ease or a release that can happen as the mind sees through that delusion. But the seeing of that, at least in my experience, it's particular conditions that come together for us to see through a particular delusion. And those conditions that allow us to see through a particular delusion, impermanent, often impermanent. And so it's not a mistake, actually, when the delusion comes back. It's the nature of the impermanence of the conditions that let us to see that thing clearly. And yet, having seen something clearly, having seen through a delusion like that, that gives us more capacity to then recognize, oh, this is just delusion at work. I know that the mind knows that it has seen through it before. It knows it's seeing through this delusional filter. There can be a kind of a clarity of like, yeah, this is not trustable. This is delusion. Even if we can't see through the delusion in that moment, there's a way that we can know it is delusion. And that, right there, we're back in the domain. We are in the domain of knowing what's here. It's like, oh, this is taking something to be permanent that's not permanent. So we can begin to, we start with the information of hearing. I think I'm so grateful for the Buddha to pointing these particular delusions out, to say, yeah, be curious about these particular things, this will help you to find the ways that you're clinging, because it is around these delusions that clinging operates. So we need to hear the information and be curious, investigate the ways that we're taking things to be permanent, reliable self. And then we begin to understand, to see the impermanent, unreliable, not self nature of experience. This talk has a lot of information in it, and one way to take in a talk like this is just to let it kind of land, just kind of like sometimes talk about this is, you know, Dharma talk is kind of like rain. It's nourishment. It's nourishment for the soil. You know, it's nourishment for our system to hear these things. And the way rain seeps into the land, just lands on the land and seeps in, and then the plants take it up as it seeps in, just very naturally. So let this talk, this information, just be like Dharma rain. You don't have to do anything with it. Like it can go in, and perhaps there'll be a moment in the meditation where the conditions are such that, like the plant taking up the moisture that seeps down, the mind sees something in a different way because it's heard this information. You do not have to think about this talk. You don't have to figure anything out. In fact, just forget about it. Let it land and nourish you in the way that it does. Thank you.